So, be honest, I didn't get to your exams. I was busier this week than I anticipated. I didn't have a vacation. I actually worked harder than I do on a normal week, so it was just insane. But I will get to them today. I have today off, so. I am also working on the next Constitution assignment. I've finished the governor. I just got to finish up with the other executive officers. And then I'm going to do the judiciary branch. And that will have given you the opportunity to go through and read the Constitution and actually understand what's actually in there. And that's not a bad thing. But as I said before, you know, we don't have cumulative exams. We've done exam number two. So put a line in your notes. We're going to start up on exam number three. We're going to do the governors. We're going to do the court system. Then we're going to do the bureaucracy. And then we're going to finish up on the last section, which is local government and like elections and political parties and that kind of stuff. All right. So, in our country, the chief executive in all of the states and territories have, as a result of English tradition, have had the title of governor. That is what we refer to our chief executives on the state levels as governors. Governors retain what is referred to as the police power. Commonly executive powers, commonly referred to as the policing power. Meaning, it's their job to basically act like a cop for their state or their territory. Their job is to enforce the laws. Their job is to make sure that everybody in their state adheres to the rules, the laws that are passed through the legislative process. Now, some state governors are real powerful. Some are not as powerful. The reason being is each state has their own constitution. Each state has their own legal system. So essentially, it's the job of the chief executive to manage and act in accordance to the law. Now, interestingly enough, technically, governors are not subordinates of the federal government. Meaning, the governor does not have to do what the president tells them. They are the head within their own sphere. But of course, we know, as the result of the federal republic that we have, in many ways the national government is overarching, sits above the states, thanks to history and tradition that we covered, and the Supremacy Clause. So while the federal government can't compel a governor to act in a certain way, the governors cannot necessarily go against federal law without there being some type of repercussions. Now, your book assigns to the governors many roles. I think your book has like six specific areas. But at the basic level, governors serve as the political heads of the state, as well as the ceremonial heads. So their job is not only to enforce the law, but to kind of set the policy, to set the tone, based on the will of the people, so to speak. Questions so far? All right. Now, in every single state, governors are directly elected by the people. Meaning, there's no electoral college. Governor's not appointed.
to get into the office, the people have a chance to vote directly for their candidate. We have a gubernatorial election coming up in November. From what I understand, I could be wrong. I don't think there's anyone running against Maura Healey on the Democrat side, but I think there are at least three potential challengers on the Republican side, and I'm sure there'll be a Libertarian or a Green Party candidate, because there always is. But when November rolls around, if you vote, you go into the voting booth, you will have the ability to cast a vote directly for the candidate of your choosing. And to win, they have to get a majority of the votes. Now, it should be noted that the vast majority of states have their gubernatorial elections on the midterm year. Meaning, I think it's 36 the last time I counted, 36 states are going to have their gubernatorial elections at the same time as we do. So it's not the presidential election year, it's the two-year election that's midterm in between. Only Virginia, I think, there's another state besides Virginia, has their election on an odd number year. It was, New Jersey? I think it was New Jersey as well.
New Jersey.
Yeah. So last November, this past one, that's when Virginia held theirs and New Jersey held theirs. There might have been another one, but I definitely remember those two. The rest, hold it on the presidential year. Now, in most states, because of either statute, the Constitution, or tradition, governors wield a tremendous amount of power. We'll use the example of the current governor, and then I'll use an example of the past governor, Charlie Baker. Maura Healey has done two things which kind of are shocking to small people who are conservative or people who like the idea of a small government. One of the things that she's doing is she's using the executive branch to stymie the audit. So 2 years ago, 72% of voters voted to have our state legislature have the books audited by our duly elected state auditor. And the governor has not sided with the people on that. She has chose to side with Senate President Spilka and House Speaker Mariano. Why? Don't know. She also took a very controversial gun law that was passed in the midnight hours, and she rammed it through, claiming that there was a state of an emergency. And she did something that no other governor in the last 150 years has done. She mandated that it went into effect immediately, as opposed to waiting the normal 90 days that every other law that's been passed in the last 150 years has gone through. The reason being is that the people have the ability to make laws, new laws coming in, be paused if they put forward a ballot question to repeal the law. Well, the group that was for it, or for repealing the law, gathered like 90,000 signatures, and it's going to be on the ballot. So instead of the law going into effect, what would have happened is the law would have been paused until this election.
Well, she wielded this emergency power and mandated that it go into effect.
And there was nothing that anyone could do to stop.
I'll give you a Republican example. During the COVID, Republican Charlie Baker suspended all constitutional rights and essentially implemented what could be defined as martial law. If you recall, I know it's getting on, and I'm sure some of you were just young teenagers, you could not gather with your family. The governor said you couldn't have more than 10 people in your house at a time. Your own house. Governor shut down the churches. Government shut down restaurants. The only stores that the governor allowed to be open were the Walmarts in the liquor stores, which I got a chuckle out of. But the government did this all through executive order. So the governor, if they want to, they could easily become tyrants. And there is very little checks and balances to stop the most egregious outlays of power. Now, why?
Well, truth be told, there are times of emergency that justify such actions.
But whether you agree or you disagree, that's politics.
So again, I'm just trying to be fair, I'm just trying to give you examples that are happening in our state.
It doesn't take much to look across the country, and you'll see other examples. And it's not just the Democrats doing it, and it's not just the Republicans doing it. You have individuals that get into office and they think that they are above the people, and they basically can ram through whatever policies they want. There is no greater power than the governor's power to stop laws from being passed. The most important power, arguably, is the veto. It's part of our checks and balances. Think about it. People elect representatives to go to the state legislature to pass laws on their behalf. And the governor has the power to say, no. Now, of course, when we talk about the legislative process, we know it's not a simple no. It has to be a qualified negative veto. The governor just has to explain why they're opposed to the law. And of course, in every single state, the legislature has the ability to override that veto. But having the ability to say no is powerful. And because of statute, the veto power can either be the entire bill, or it could be what's called a line item veto. 43 states, not Massachusetts, but 43 states allow the governor to veto a part of a bill. Most states to override are like Massachusetts, needs a two-thirds vote in both chambers, but there are some states that require a three-fifth. Interestingly enough, there are four states that it's real easy to override a governor's veto. Alabama, Indiana, Kentucky, and Tennessee. That just takes a simple majority of those present. But, again, to be fair, checks and balances, is it possible for the representatives of the people to try passing a law that goes against the interests of the people? Absolutely. Absolutely. Again, as our Constitution says, the whole job of the governor is not to be beholden to the legislature.
The purpose of the governor is to basically maintain law and order in the Constitution and the values of the state in which they govern.
questions. All right.
Another power of the governor's is the appointment power. But there can be no more powerful appointment than the ability of the governor to choose who's going to fill a vacancy if one of the United States Senators' seats is vacant. In some 47 states, the governors are allowed to put somebody in if there's a vacancy. There are 3 states that do not allow it.
Not that you need to remember for the exam, but it's Oregon, Alaska, and Wisconsin.
In those states, if there's a vacancy, there must be a special election.
Now, in Massachusetts,
the laws were changed twice in my lifetime because of politics. So the way it was, if there's an opening, the governor could appoint an acting senator. But the acting senator could basically fill the term. So if, say, I'm having a brain fart of our senators, because I haven't had all the coffee here today. Pocahontas. Elizabeth Warren. Yeah, Elizabeth Warren. Let's say Elizabeth Warren dies. Well, the way it used to be is that Mora could just basically put somebody in, and that person could fill out the rest of the term. But an interesting thing occurred in 2004. In 2004, we had a vacancy when John Kerry decided to run for president against George W. Bush. He resigned his office. The problem was, we had a Republican governor at that time, Mitt Romney. So the Democrats, who made up a supermajority in the legislature, did not want to give Romney the power to appoint a Republican senator that would have remained in office for 4 years. At a time when the balance in the Senate was like a 50-50 split. So, the Democrat majority in our legislature conspired, rapid fire, pushed through an emergency measure, which Mitt Romney vetoed and then they overrode. The new law allowed to fill until special election. So Romney could put someone into the seat, and they could sit there until Massachusetts had a special election. Democrats figured they were safe because the woman who decided to run was former State Attorney General Martha Coakley. Democrat, but not progressive Democrat by any means. She was what was once known as a blue dog Democrat. She was a fiscal conservative Democrat. So everyone figured it's Massachusetts, we only vote Democrat, so this is going to be a shoo-in. But much to the horror of the politicos in Massachusetts, Republican Scott Brown ran one of the most brilliant senatorial elections in state history. He didn't do the highfalutin, you know, political gatherings, and he didn't like dress up in suits, and he didn't appear to be, you know, pomp and circumstance. He spent the time running up to the special election driving around the state. And again, he had money. I'm not saying this was legit, but it was a brilliant tactic. He drove around the state in an old pickup truck. And wherever he went, he wore work boots and jeans and like a Carhartt jacket that wasn't new. It was all beat up. He also utilized one of the most popular rock radio stations that was once on the air, WAAF. And he ran a race that was just grassroots completely. And he won. It shocked the system. So he served out the remaining part of John Kerry's term, only to lose to Elizabeth Warren. Well, then Ted Kennedy died. But Ted Kennedy died when we had a Democrat, Deval Patrick, in office. So they changed the law again. And they went back to the way it was. That's politics, baby. All right. Now, another thing that governors are supposed to do is they are supposed to provide an annual report to the people, commonly referred to as the State of the State Address. Now, there is no requirement that it be on TV. But in the modern media age, there isn't a governor across the country that doesn't give some type of state of the state address. Our governor goes upstairs, because her office is on the second floor, but up on the third floor, that's where the House chamber is. So she goes into the House chamber, which is the biggest chamber, and she gives the annual State of the State address. And it's like the State of the Union address. They get up and they give a speech. It's usually about an hour or so. They say, you know, the Commonwealth is strong. And they talk about all of their policy accomplishments and objectives. And of course, you know, there's the partisan clapping game, which makes them all look like a bunch of SEALs. Ooh, ooh, ooh. You know, when their guy or gal is up there, oh, we're going to applaud. But when it's the other side, it's like, no, we're not going to applaud. It's all theater. But again, the intent of this, and it is in our Constitution, the intent is that the governor provides transparency. You know, remember, one of the duties of being a citizen of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts is that you keep yourself informed on what's happening. Well, in order for that to happen, the governor has to make this report. Now, back in the day, it used to just be a written speech, and it would be published in the newspapers. But of course, who buys newspapers nowadays? All right, there is one thing in here that I do want to mention. There's one other thing. Most chief executives are given the ability to live in a governor's mansion. Most states have their own mini versions of the White House. Interestingly enough, we are one of the few states that do not.
The reason being,
back during the contentious years after the French and Indian War leading up to the War of Independence, Boston in particular saw lots of protests spearheaded by the Sons of Liberty. In one of those protests, I can't remember if it was against the Stamp Act or the Tea Act, I don't remember. But the governor's mansion was actually set on fire and burned to the ground. In a symbol of resistance to an actual crown.
And when those Sons of Liberty became the founding fathers of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, they were adamant that they would never build a palace for an executive again.
And one of the weird things is that in the 250 years since, there has never been a governor that has pushed for it. So, what do most governors do? Well, they are allotted a housing expense. So what they usually end up doing is they end up renting an apartment in and around Boston. Although the interesting one was Deval Patrick. He lived out in Williamstown, north of North Adams.
Why can't we even talk this far?
He used to commute in. But you know how he got to commute in? The state police flew him in a helicopter.
Oh, one of the weird things was, here's another little factoid, because again, I'm older than you,
was that when Jane Swift, who was our first woman governor, she was lieutenant governor for Paul Cellucci, and Paul Cellucci, who was a Republican, resigned to go become the ambassador of Canada.
Canada?
I think it was Canada. Jane Swift became governor, but at the time, Jane Swift was actually living in Waynesville.
So she also was pregnant when she became governor.
So there was a couple of times when her belly started getting really big, the state police went and picked her up, and they landed in, if you know where Fopama Farms are, on Hill Street. They landed there to pick her up. And that got in the news, and that was controversial. God, pregnant woman flown in at the taxpayer's expense to be governor.
But, I just mention it because it's not... I don't make it sound like I'm only bash Democrats. Both sides do it. All right. So what do they officially have to do? What is their job? Well, your book describes it as our governors wear many hats. Meaning they just don't have a job. They actually have multiple jobs.
One of the most important hats that they wear, as I've already said, they're the ones who are in charge of making public policy, developing the ideas, formulating strategies, and hopefully encouraging the legislator to put those policies into law.
Again, as the face of the state,
they are supposed to basically guide how the state acts during their time in office.
Policy is simple principles or rules guiding decisions.
So, let's say we're going to implement a policy in which we are going to try to
level fund government operations. Basically, the policy would be the desire not to increase the costs of operating the different government departments. So the executive would mention that. But the actual implementation would be done by the people below the executive. Now, as far as policies of the current governor, because of her chosen lifestyle, she has implemented a lot of LGBTQ plus. I don't know the rest. I'm not trying to be, I know there's a whole bunch, I just don't know. But to help out people that live marginal lifestyles, she also, as a policy, has tried guiding the government, you know, to be anti-racist, implement DEI, programs like that. She doesn't actually design the policies, but she basically mandates, you know, that there are areas of change that should be recognized. One of the things that's very common, and it's been very costly during her time in office, and it's one of the things that is causing our state budget to go through the roof, she has hired something like 8,000 DEI coordinators and have plugged them into all of the different state departments. Why? Again, she wants the policy, so she's trying to basically fulfill those expectations. Every single governor is allowed to do the same. But governors run into problems when they try forcing policy through without working with the bureaucracy, all of the state departments, the bureaucracy, or the legislature, or even trying to do things that the majority of people support. Because at the end of the day, being a governor, to a degree, it is kind of like a popularity contest, if you want to stay in office. Now, the governor also is in charge of marshaling legislative action. This is what how the book describes it. Marshaling legislative action. Basically, the only way that the governor can accomplish what they want to is through the legislative process. If they want to spearhead change, innovation, progress, use whatever phrase you want, the only way it can become permanent is through legislative action. The policy must be codified into law, or the programs must be funded by law. Now, in most states, all governors can do is act like cheerleaders. In our state, our governor, because our governor is a citizen of the Commonwealth, they actually have the ability to petition the legislature for a law. But the only way to get something passed, of course, is to work with the legislative leaders. But this is not easy to do because of partisanship, personality, and elections, potential elections. They all impact the relationship that governors have with their legislative leaders. So, case in point, Maura Healey, in terms of legislative success, has been largely successful because she is a progressive Democrat, and the current leadership in our state house are also progressive Democrats. So there's no partisanship conflict. It's not like the D's versus the R's. And they are relied on policy and many principles. Whereas, you go back when Charlie Baker was governor, and Charlie Baker really didn't push many laws through. Because again, he was an R, and the leaders were Ds. But there are times that even being the same political party doesn't guarantee success. Before Charlie Baker was Deval Patrick, Democrat. There were many times when Deval pushed for initiatives and the state legislative leaders outright said no.
There were a couple of times he tried vetoing measures and they overrode his vetoes.
Why? Well, those legislative leaders didn't get along with Deval Patrick. So you just never know. There's no one universal truth. It really just depends upon the personalities and what's going on. Because there are times when a Democrat and a Republican can get along great.
When Paul Cellucci was governor and Bill Weld was governor, two Republican governors from the 90s,
sure, they butted heads on some things with the Democrat majority, because again, Massachusetts has had a Democrat majority in our state house since the 1960s. But back then, in the 90s, the majority of the Democrats were conservatives.
So they found common ground through principle, through goals, as opposed to party.
There's your partisanship. There's your personality.
The other interesting thing that could impact relations is elections.
If
the governor is popular and the clock is ticking and elections are getting nearer, the legislative branch may play nice and pass laws that popular governor wants. Or, if the governor's not popular, they might block everything
in that election year.
The best example of that I can give you is when Jesse the Body Ventura, former wrestler, was governor of Minnesota. He's kind of a fruitcake. He's a real interesting fruity guy. And he really, really irked both the Democrats, because he was an independent. He irked the Democrats and the Republicans in the Minnesota state legislature.
And so when he was as governor, throughout most of his time in office, he wasn't able to get anything through. Because both the D's and R's were like, dude, you're not going to win re-election. So why are we going to work with you?
But that's not to say that the governor doesn't have the power to grease the palms of the legislatures to help get accomplishments through.
Because they can add to the budget what is commonly referred to as pork.
Sometimes called pork barrel. Pretty much what it is it's money.
It's money for special projects that get added to the budget
in exchange for a little quid pro quo.
So, let's say the governor wants to push through a new law that increases the age of smoking. Well, many of the legislators
think that whatever the current age is now, I think it's 21, is high enough.
But the governor really wants to get it through. So what the governors will do is they'll actually add into the budget grants or other monies for projects in that legislature's home district.
Quid pro quo. Good example. Auburn representative Paul Frost. He is running for re-election for like the 20th time. And I don't really like him that much. I think he's kind of useless. Well, he brags on his campaign information that he never misses votes. So he's always there. He shows up. But he cannot name a single legislative accomplishment, a single law that he thought of and helped push through. Because he's a Republican in a House with a supermajority of Democrats. And then when you show up and you look at his voting record, because all of that's put out there, he frequently votes for anything the Democrats want. So he doesn't try to counter, you know, if the Democrat law is bad, the Republican should vote against it. He just kind of goes along with the flow. So he's basically a Republican in name only. But what does he get? Well, every single term, he gets funding for like the Auburn Fire Department. He gets funding to help build some new parks that are in Auburn. The big sports field complex that was paid for by the doctor there, that was also supplemented with a lot of state money. He's getting some extra money for like the Route 20 project. So, in exchange for him voting with the Democrats, the Democrat governor makes sure there's monies that will go to his district that he can turn around and say to his constituents, look, I'm bringing home the bacon.
Is it illegal? Not at all. Is it ethical? That's up to the voters to decide. Questions? All right. The next
element of what a governor does
is they have to administer the executive branch. They are, after all, the chief executive. So technically, they are in charge of every single state department or state commission or state board. And they are supposed to essentially control every activity by what is known as the bureaucracy. All of those ABC agencies. Now, many voters believe that the chief executive is like a king. That they have the power to control the actions of every single state employee. So they can make decrees. They can control the economy. They can wave the magic wand and make everything happen. Well, the truth of the matter is, the only power that the governor actually wields over the bureaucracy are those powers that either the Constitution or state law provides. So, truth of the matter is like in other areas, they're just a cheerleader. They can kind of encourage, say, the state's revenue service, our version of the IRS, you know, to be nice to people if they don't file their taxes in a timely manner. They can, you know, request that, you know, that the state police treat people fairly. they can, I don't know, tell, you know, DESE, Department of Elementary and Secondary Education, you know, make sure that all the kiddos are getting good educations. But they have no actual authority to force them to comply. They can't hire or fire the people that make up the bureaucracy. They don't give them job evaluations or reviews. Because the bureaucracy is a hierarchy. And while the governor technically is the head, the only people they have direct authority over are the department heads or cabinet secretaries that they appoint. But below that level, they have no say over the actual operation of how the bureaucracy works. So even though this is a national level example, and again, it's political like so many things, but again, just trying to give you an example that you may be aware of. When President Trump was in his first term, he made a huge mistake that ultimately ran himself into trouble, and that's one of the reasons why he was not reelected in 2020. He, being a New York Democrat businessman, believed that because everybody loved him for as long as I can remember, going back to the early 80s, super popular, and he could negotiate and work with everybody, he believed that when he became president, it would be the same case. So he chose not to fire all of the different directors or department heads. Now, by the way, Barack Obama did that. Within the first month of Barack Obama's presidency, he fired something like 7,000 department heads that worked for the federal government and replaced them with all of his people. George W. Bush did the same thing with Clinton's people. Bill Clinton did the same thing with Father Bush, H.W. Bush's people. That's kind of what presidents do. But Trump did not, because he thought he could work with anybody. And the problem was, is many of Trump's problems in the first term were he was being undermined by the bureaucracy, because he could not control them. He could not control the CIA or the FBI, our intelligence agencies. He could not control the Treasury or any of the other departments. So when he came in this time, what did he do? Learned his lesson, fired everybody. And he brought in only people he could trust. Well, if governors don't do that, they're not going to be able to run their states. Plus, one of the ways to make sure that governors can't be kings is those walls of separation of power. Many of the statutes passed by legislative bodies that create the different government agencies put in the laws themselves that the governor has no say over day-to-day operations. That the government agency, you know, has to report to the legislative branch, because the legislature has oversight authority. And there are also checks and balances. If the governor oversteps, he could be sued in his official capacity. Case could go to court. Or if the governor acts really egregiously, it could be impeached. So if the only way that governors can be effective is they have to be like CEOs of corporations. So they get the directives by the board of directors, which of course are the people,
and they have to maintain the general operations of the company in such a way that pleases the board of directors. But CEOs don't go down to the docks and work the forklift. They don't pick up the broom and sweep the halls or empty the trash or monitor people's time clocks. There are other people in the hierarchy that are responsible for those duties. So, to be effective, they have to be mindful of the scope and scale of the operations of which they oversee. Questions? All right, the next hat that governors wear, according to the book, this is an easy one. They're the masters of the ceremonies. They are allowed to greet dignitaries. They are allowed to award state decorations or honors or medals. They are allowed to issue symbolic proclamations. Or they're allowed to attend, you know, events in official capacity. Like in Massachusetts, the governors always go out to the Big E, for example. So what does this mean? Well, you will see Maura Healey wearing the Dunkin' Donuts outfit that was on the Dunkin' Donuts Super Bowl commercial. You know, because Dunkin' Donuts is a Massachusetts corporation. So she hangs out with Mark Wahlberg and Tom Brady and all those people. You know, cheerleading, oh, buy Dunkin' Donuts, yay! Or she'll show up at a Celtics basketball game wearing like a Celtics jersey. Yay, go Celtics! Or sometimes they may go out and throw the opening day pitch, or, you know, or show up if there's a championship when they have the duck boat parades. All state governors basically do that. You know, you're basically, you know, serving as this person that wants to celebrate and commemorate, you know, good things that happen within the state. Now, believe it or not, in a minority of states, governors actually get inaugural day parades, just like they give to the president. Not in Massachusetts, though. The next job, and this is important as well, they are entrusted with coordinating intergovernmental relations. Intergovernment relations. They are the point men and women for our state in our federal republic. Meaning, they are supposed to represent the state in all things in interactions with the federal government. So, for example, if there's a natural disaster in a state, you know, typically the governors put aside any partisan or politic BS, and they'll be on the phone coordinating oftentimes with the White House directly. Now, interestingly enough, sometimes that actually hurts the governors. Way before you probably were aware of anything political, back in 2012, a hurricane called Katrina smashed into New Jersey, causing catastrophic damage. And the governor of, not Katrina, what was the hurricane? That Katrina was New Orleans. I don't remember. It was a hurricane. Sandy. Oh, yeah, Sandy. Yeah, thank you, Sandy. And the governor at the time, Chris Christie, was thinking about running as the Republican candidate
for the president, really popular, a moderate Republican, well-liked in his state. Well, in the midst of the electoral cycle, the hurricane hit, and he invited Barack Obama, who he was going to run against, to New Jersey. And they embraced one another, they yucked it up, had a grand old time, and all of it was captured in the media, and the conservative media crucified Chris Christie. Because Obama was supposed to be the enemy in a presidential election year.
But,
think about when Puerto Rico was hit in a hurricane. This was back in 2018 or something like that. President Trump flew down to Puerto Rico
and met with the Democrat governor at the time. And they had such a positive interaction that President Trump made sure extra supplies got down to Puerto Rico.
And the governor was received so popularly, she got reelected.
So sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. It just depends upon the political situation. But at the end of the day, the easiest way to have a communication, particularly during emergency times, is one-to-one.
Governors are also supposed to interact with other states. I mean, think about our geographic location. New Hampshire, Vermont, New York, Connecticut, Rhode Island, they all surround us.
Even though we like to think that things happen in Massachusetts in a bubble, truth be told, a lot of stuff that happens in our state spills over and impacts other states.
So one of the ways to maintain good relations is that the governors often spend time calling and speaking with one another.
But sometimes they fight one another.
So way back in 2010-ish, I think, there was a huge drought in the South. And waters in Tennessee were not going down. I think I talked about this before. We're not going downstream to Georgia. And Atlanta was on a situation where they were down to like 1 week left of drinking water.
Well, the governor of Georgia was constantly on the phone with the governor of Tennessee, begging the governor of Tennessee to open up the dams to allow more water to go downstream.
But the problem was, is much of Tennessee, they get their power through the TVA, the Tennessee Valley Authority. They built massive dams that house water and they generate hydroelectricity. So Tennessee was resistant to open up the dams because if they let too much water out, they wouldn't be able to power their turbines. Luckily, Mother Nature jumped in right at the critical point and opened up several weeks of good rain, so the situation was able to normalize, but it could have been crisis.
And governors are also supposed to interact with the municipalities in their state.
When Charlie Baker was governor for his two terms, he made it a point to make sure that either he or Karen Polito, who was the lieutenant governor, visited all 351 municipalities in each of their two terms. I think they're the only executive duo that did that.
Why? Well, the people in the small towns, particularly outside of the 12895 corridor, like to think that their lives are important too.
And it's kind of a big to-do when the governor comes to town.
Karen Polito came to Sutton. Mora has never come to Sutton.
But Deval Patrick did. And he came to Sutton unannounced. He ended up going up to Whittier's Farms and visited the farm store unannounced. And I remember talking to the Whittier family. They didn't even realize it was him until he showed up in the Chronicle, the local newspaper, because after he went to Whittier's, he went to Puffin's in Millbury and had breakfast. And a reporter caught it and put it in the newspaper. So it's just, it's really cool when these governors go out and, you know, mingle with the people. Now, one of the most important groups in terms of governors' intergovernmental relations is an organization known as the National Governors Association. Every single governor is a member of this by default. And what they do is they meet twice a year and they try coordinating policies on a regional or even a national level. Because after all, there's not any state in our country that's a complete outlier. You know, every single state is having funding issues. Every single state's having issues with health care. Every single state's having issues with a crewing fire apparatus. So if every governor is dealing with the same stuff, it kind of makes sense that, you know, they sit down and talk amongst one another and kind of figure out what's working and what's not. Do the last two quick. Governors are also supposed to promote economic development. One of the best things that they can do is they can attempt to recruit businesses. Charlie Baker worked really hard to lure General Electric, their headquarters, from Connecticut. They bulldozed a site out near UMass Boston. And GE began constructing a massive complex. But because of the increase in taxes and regulations in Boston, thanks to Mayor Wu, General Electric announced they're actually going to shut down operations and pull out and go to another state, taking something like 300 high-paying jobs with them. Why? Well, Governor DeSantis in Florida is making a better deal. Come down to Florida. You don't have to pay income taxes. Property taxes are like next to nothing. Very little government regulations. And if you look around all the states that have high taxes, high regulations, businesses are leaving and going south. And by the way, it's going to cripple us. There's a study that was released in the Boston Globe that suggests that we've lost upwards of $4 billion in potential tax revenue last year because of all of the businesses that have moved out of Massachusetts. Why? Businesses don't have to stay in states. Businesses can move, particularly if they're not appreciated. So, Smith & Wesson, gun manufacturer, had three or four factories out in, they had some in Westfield, they had some in Springfield. Because of the anti-gun nature of Massachusetts, they've moved all of their operations down to Tennessee. Took with them 500 jobs. So, the governors are allowed to do that. They're allowed to go poach. Governors are also supposed to encourage tourism. So when Governor Dukakis was governor of Massachusetts in the 1980s, he actually went on an ad that was paid for by the state. I think the song had something along the lines of, like, anyone can make it in Massachusetts or something like that.
So the state actually spends a lot of money producing brochures and information about all the stores' sites in hopes of luring people to come to your state. Because tourists bring money, and they spend, and it helps local businesses. Governors also travel abroad. They do that sometimes to see if they can build up economic relationships with international companies. Pretty self-explanatory. And the last one, because we're almost out of time, I got seconds left. They're also generally assumed to be the head of their political party. They are regarded as the highest ranking member in the state party, but they don't really control the party per se. Meaning they can't pick who's going to run for office. But what they can do is they can go out and they can help. So if the governor is popular, they will go out on the campaign trail and campaign with a potential candidate. The best example of this that I can leave you with, again, goes back to Democrat Deval Patrick. When Elizabeth Warren ran the first time, she was awful. Awful candidate. She could not speak. She sounded complete inept, foolish. So in order to help get her comfortable with speaking to the media, Deval often led the interviews. Well, that allowed her to get her traction in, and now she's more effective if you like her. I personally don't care for her, but again, that's she's not my cup of tea. All right, questions. All right, so I am almost done, as I told a couple of people that here early. I'm making you the next, the final round of Constitution assignments. I've got the governor one done. It's only, I think, 8 questions, small questions. Same thing, you're going to go through and you're going to find these points. But I'm going to do one, I've got to do a section for the lieutenant governor, governor's council, the other state executive officers, and the judiciary. So I will hopefully have those, and then at some point before the next test, I'll have them due, and we'll do like we did on the last exam, where if you submit it, you don't have to do essays. All right? All right. Oh, and you will see your grades by end of day or tomorrow. I just didn't have a chance to work over them on the weekend, but I'll get them done for you. Take care. See you on Thursday.